This happened over 10 years ago. We were making one of our summer family visits to southern West Virginia. I took my then high school age son. He's celebrated his 28th birthday this past week, but he was high school then. Him and a cousin of his, one of my nieces, to a recreation park just outside of Charleston, West Virginia. It was pretty standard fare, a mini golf course, a video game arcade, a go-kart track, and a large water area for paddle boats. We were sharing a pizza. His cousin was off playing a video game, and we got into a conversation about the locale where we were. I told Gordon that when I was in high school, what was now the paddle boat area was a very large swimming pool that had been made at the base of a stone quarry that partly surrounded us. It was called Rock Lake Pool. It was the nicest, best equipped, and by far the biggest public swimming pool in the whole Charleston area, and only white people were allowed to swim there. His cousin is Indian. She was adopted by one of my sisters and brother-in-law from India. She is quite dark-skinned. I told Gordon that when I was his age and when this place was Rock Lake Pool, your cousin in all likelihood would not have been allowed in here. It was almost beyond his comprehension to think that such a thing could be, particularly within the lifetime of his father. What was for my generation in the time and place where I was raised, just how the world worked, was for my son almost impossible to grasp. Just how the world worked. When it came to swimming areas, the world worked in odd ways in the time and place where I was a teenager. If you were white, you could swim at Rock Lake Pool. A few miles away from Rock Lake, though, was a pool run by the local 4-H organization. It was racially integrated. And then there was an indoor pool at a local college, West Virginia State College, an historically Negro, as they were called, college that was also open to whites. And the state college pool was open to groups from, say, churches or school groups or a scout troop who wanted to use it, and race didn't matter. If you were white and went swimming there, you were often in a minority in that setting. So we had then Rock Lake Pool, the 4-H pool, and the state college pool. One was for whites only, one was integrated, and one was primarily but not exclusively for African Americans. It was how the world worked. As I was coming of age in this setting, a young Baptist minister was beginning his career in Birmingham, Alabama. He was a few hundred miles to the south of where I was, and in a much more racially divided, even apartheid-like setting there. He and his associates also witnessed the way the world worked, including a member of his congregation named Rosa Parks. Except she decided one day she didn't have to accept the way the world worked, because it really wasn't how the world worked anyway. It was how persons of power and privilege had decided that the world, the piece of the world they could control anyway, was going to work. And it didn't have to be so forever. And in time, it wasn't the way the world worked after all. As for me, at some point in my high school years, I decided this wasn't the way the world should work either when it came to who could swim where. I was still very much in a Jesus-centered religious place then. Jesus really was my Lord and Savior. He wasn't a whole lot of help to me in any of the football games I played in, but he was still my Lord and Savior. I had to throw that in, didn't I? But at some point, I actually asked myself if Jesus would go swimming at Rock Lake Pool, which was kind of hard to envision, since I couldn't quite picture my Lord and Savior in swimming trunks and flying down the big water slide. Or, for that matter, I asked myself, was Jesus even a white guy anyway? And since I could not definitively answer yes to either question, I ended up taking a pass on swimming at Rock Lake. It was integrated a few years later with the civil rights legislation that came along a little bit later in the mid-1960s. I have today one more opportunity to share a Martin Luther King Sunday with you. We've had some very memorable Sundays on this day in years past, especially that very moving message that Harvey Key gave us last year. Being in a reflective mood this year, I want to recall for a time then this morning the culture that first shaped my racial consciousness and how my consciousness changed and evolved as I moved beyond that culture and into the various ministries I've had over the past 40 years. One perk I've noticed of growing older is that folks don't seem to mind too much, if you tell some of the same stories. That is, as long as you don't get too terribly repetitious about it. So don't stop me if you've heard these ones before. I'm going to tell them anyway. You just heard my story of the swimming pools, and what I still take from that is how you can be, particularly as a young white kid in a particular time and place, how you can be inside of a racist system and not see anything wrong with it until you take a step back from it. Since I swam in all three pools, I had no problem really interacting with persons of color, but I unreflectively accepted the givenness of some places being off limits to persons of color while others were not. One need not, that is to say, be personally racist in order to participate in a racist system. And this gets me to my next story. When I was in the sixth grade, going to an all-white school, my hometown created a second junior high school. The baby boomer bulge was overcrowding schools even where I lived, and so a second junior high was needed to accommodate us boomers as we became teenagers. A few miles east of our part of town where I lived was a school that had been a grammar school for African American children. It was generally referred to in my circles as the colored school. I didn't even know its real name, just the colored school after on the end of town. By the time I started attending it in the 7th, 8th, and 9th grades, it was, and still is, called William McKinley Junior High. When it came to my racial consciousness, McKinley was a really good place for me to be. For the first time in my life, this was 1957, 3 years after Brown versus Board of Education, I interacted daily with African American kids, and as the saying goes, we played well together. At school, that is. 3 o'clock, we all got back on our buses and went back to our segregated neighborhoods. Some of the teachers who had been there at the school before it became William McKinley Junior High stayed on, and for the first time in my life, I encountered persons in positions of authority, authority over me, no less. Every once in a while, though, I'd see stenciled on the back of folding chairs or on stationery that a teacher was using for scrap paper the words Carter G. Woodson School. I learned the school had previously been called the Carter Woodson School. I was 12 years old. It never occurred to me to ask why it still wasn't being called the Carter Woodson School. It was McKinley Junior High. That was the way the world worked. Some 10 years later, I was in theological school in Rochester, New York. I had to read a book called Before the Mayflower for a class I was taking on the history of the African American church. I came across the name Carter Woodson. I discovered as I read on that he was an outstanding black educator and historian, the second African American after William E.B. Du Bois to earn a Ph.D. from Harvard in 1912. He founded the Journal of Negro History and was instrumental in starting Negro History Week in February, which has now become Black History Month. He had roots in southern West Virginia and had been a dean at the aforementioned West Virginia State College. It was right and good that a school for black students in that area be named for him. But when white kids like me began attending that school, the name Carter G. Woodson had to go. All this hit me as I sat in my seminary library. So that's who Carter Woodson was. I felt a certain kind of shame come over me. Not that I was personally responsible for any of it. Like I said, I was only 12. But I realized that in order for it to be okay for a white kid like me to attend the junior high that I did, and even with all of its positive racial experiences I had there, the name of one of this nation's very prominent African-American educators had to be expunged. The epiphany I had sitting there in my seminary library was an early lesson in institutional racism. It had nothing to do with my personal feelings about black people. It had everything to do instead with being a part, albeit unconsciously, a part of a system that could render black people invisible if the need, so to speak, arose. I also remember from my seminary days a story one of my African-American classmates named Charles shared in a group discussion. He told of how, as a young boy, he was walking down a street with his mother in the southern town where he was raised, and it was a very hot day. He wanted a drink of water. There was no place handy where he could get one. His mother went to the front door of a restaurant, knowing they couldn't go in, but she asked the owner, who happened to be on hand, if she could have a glass of water for her son that he could just drink standing there in the restaurant doorway. The owner wanted to accommodate her, but could not be seen doing so in public. He asked the mother to go around the back door to an alley, and he'd bring out a glass of water for the youngster, now a classmate about my age, to drink. Charles described what it was like for him as a young boy to see what his mother had to do in order, just for him, to get a drink. I learned then, as I listened to his story, what white privilege is. It's not necessarily about being in a privileged position, either economically or socially, because one happens to be white. I grew up in a family, as I've related on other occasions, where we sometimes lived right on the economic edge when it came to our being able to afford even some of the basic necessities of life. But as economically challenged, if I can use that phrase, as economically challenged as my family of origin was, I was still protected from ever having to witness either of my parents ever being humiliated in the way that Charles saw with his mother, just for the sake of a glass of water. I remember that story many years later here in Nashua, when for a time I was serving on the board of a local NAACP chapter. One of my fellow board members, an African American woman, told about how she was cleaning her house one day, and she was dressed in the garb most of us wear when doing some serious house cleaning. Salesperson came to the door. When she answered it, he took a look at her and asked if the owner of the house was in or should he come back later. The woman was actually the owner of the house. But it was the eyes of that salesperson. She was the cleaning lady. It is these kinds of slights, however unintentional or not they may be, these kinds of slights that still exist, that I remain shielded from because of my race. The most vivid memory I have of my 4 years of divinity school was the night and the following days, and I spoke to the kids about this a little earlier, Dr. King's assassination. A community-wide memorial service was held in our chapel. And when I saw the faces of the men and the women and the children from Rochester's black community who streamed into that chapel, I realized that for all the shock and the grief that I felt as a 22-year-old aspiring minister, these people had experienced a loss on a level that I could not and would not ever fully know. Well, one more seminary story remains a part of my life today. Many of you have met my sister and brother-in-law, Rose and Mel. They've spoken from this pulpit now and then. If so, you know then that they're an interracial couple. They met in the same seminary where we were all going. They're now the co-ministers of the UU congregation in Charleston, West Virginia, and they lived in Newton for many years when Mel was on the staff of our UU association. I helped them celebrate their 40th wedding anniversary a little over a year ago, and they now have grandkids. Kind of ahead of me on that one. They were married in our seminary chapel on that campus in December of 1970. My father did not attend the wedding. He could not accept the idea of his daughter marrying outside of her race. In time, the good news is, in time, he came around to accepting their marriage. And shortly before he died, at the very untimely age of 69, 8 years after Rose and Mel were married, he got to hold their first child when she was an infant, and it was the only grandchild he would live to see. My father was one of the most decent, honest, loving, and religiously devout men I've ever known. But for a time anyway, he could not get past the religious and cultural blinders he had when it came to matters of race. He had these blinders that could not even allow him to attend his first daughter's wedding. Among the many lessons I took from that whole episode is that good and sincere people can be goodly and sincerely wrong, even with all their goodness at times. But of much more importance, I learned that cultural blinders do not have to stay in place forever. They can come off. Well, it was these kinds of experiences and others from my more formative years of my life. I'm going to expand upon this topic a little bit next Sunday and speak of how my coming of age during the 1960s shaped my worldview and my understanding of ministry. For now, I'd like to turn our attention for the remainder of what I have to share today to some of the words of Dr. King's that were offered. In fact, Harvey spoke them at our chalice lighting this morning. The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. In saying these words, Martin Luther King was echoing the 19th century Unitarian minister and strong abolitionist Reverend Theodore Parker, who was the first, as best can be determined, to offer the metaphor of a moral arc of the universe bending towards justice. It was a metaphor both he and Dr. King liked to use. From the personal experiences I've cited and others like them, I've learned two things about this metaphorical arc. One is that it doesn't move by itself. And the other is that it doesn't always move in a continuously forward direction. Taking the first one first. The moral arc moves when persons of vision and commitment push it along. Above the generations, the lonely prophets rise, while truth flares as the day star within their glowing eyes. We sang these words in our opening hymn. Dr. King, like Theodore Parker a century before him, was one of those lonely prophets who rose above the generations. And that verse goes on, "And other eyes beholding are kindled by that flame. And dawn becomes the morning when prophets love proclaim." It was when other eyes and other lives caught the flame of Dr. King's vision that the moral arc moved a few more degrees to bring us to where we are now. One of the joys of my life is that I was able to be in this man's physical presence, if only for a brief time. Second point, the moral arc doesn't always move continuously forward. It ultimately does bend towards justice, but it also meets resistance, has its setbacks, provokes reaction and reactionary forces. Being a participant in moving the moral arc of the universe often requires taking the long view in the face of the powers and forces that resist its movement. We can elect an African-American president, and then we see attempts in certain states, however subtle they may be, at voter suppression as another election approaches. We witnessed this in our own community here just this past week. A group with the ironic name of the Veritas Project, ironic in that they're about anything but truth, manufactured incidents of voter fraud at some of our polling places with the ostensible agenda, I would say, of putting stipulations in place of making it harder to register to vote. The only fraud that took place was what these so-called Veritas people created with their eventual goal of suppressing votes. Various strategies of this kind are in play in a number of states at present as this presidential election approaches. Moving on. We can push successfully at times for greater efforts as part of a greater common good, to alleviate hunger and homelessness, to make quality health care available for all, to broaden the opportunities for all of our citizens to share in the bounty of our wonderful nation. The efforts to bend us towards greater levels of justice, equity, and compassion, as our UU principles put it, in these and other areas, they've hardly been in vain since Dr. King's day. Thankfully, there have been successes, but we still have to push on because that arc has not been able to move as far along as it still must. And this goes to the expansion of the basic civil rights of our citizens, civic rights of our citizens, and I'll close on this one. I take heart, actually, when I take a broad historical view and see that every effort to expand certain basic rights of our citizens in this nation has ultimately found a measure of success. The lonely prophets who called for the abolition of slavery in time saw their call heeded. The lonely prophets who called for the enfranchisement of women in time saw their call heeded. The lonely prophets who called for the end of the exploitation of child labor in time saw their call heeded. The lonely prophets who called for greater rights of working people to organize in their just interests in time saw their call heeded. And the lonely prophets in my generation who stood up to the destructiveness of the variety of forms of racism have to some extent, seen their call heeded. They met with resistance. Some lost their lives. The moral arc they sought to move got knocked off its course at times, but it did continue to bend towards justice. I take heart in that. And now we seek to move that arc again when it comes to the full enfranchisement of our gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered citizens. Here again, the arc moves forward and then is resisted by the forces of reaction. It moved forward over 2 years ago when in our state, when full marriage rights were granted to same-sex couples, and we had a wonderful celebration right here in this sanctuary when that happened. And now attempts to resist and thwart that movement are taking place. It's hard to say at this point just how the attempt to repeal same-sex marriage in New Hampshire is going to play out. We can only keep alert and do what we can. But here's what I wish. Not only for the legislators in this state who want to repeal same-sex marriage, but I wish this sincerely and honestly for all of those persons who make public policy in all of our nation's state houses and who are resisting the movement of the moral arc on this issue. I sincerely wish them, each and all, long and healthy lives. I do so, first of all, because I wish that for most anyone, but especially in this case, because I want these folks, some of them I would imagine to be as good a person as my father was. I want them to live long enough to see the day come when the denial of marriage rights to same-sex couples will be as incomprehensible to a future generation of Americans as it was incomprehensible to my son that his cousin could have, at one time in our nation's history, been denied access to a swimming pool because of the color of her skin. The legacy of Dr. King's life is in our hands 44 years after his death. On this, the very day of his 83rd birthday, may we be worthy bearers of his legacy. Let's sing together hymn number 148, "That Freedom Span Both East and West."